Hello, and welcome to episode 30 of The Winning Agenda. It's come to our attention that some of our listeners believe that our intro, in which we introduce each panelist for the episode, can sometimes be rife with unimportant information. As such, we have taken measures to eliminate all irrelevant information from our introductions. We hope this makes the podcast run more smoothly. This week, our panelists include a runner-up for the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals.
Welcome.
A three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor and runner-up for the 2015 Melbourne Regionals.
Hi.
The 2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 8 competitor.
Good evening.
And I am a 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. Episode 30, guys. It's pretty fantastic to be here, don't you think?
Yeah, it's absolutely sweet.
I mean, I know I said a few weeks ago they were pretty excited to be here after 6 months, but it's nice to have a bit of a milestone like 30. Jesse, Wilfie, you guys psyched?
Yeah, I just want to thank everyone for standing by us. You know, every week we're stoked about how many people are tuning into our podcast and how much feedback we get on Facebook, on our email, wherever else. So, yeah, keep sending it through. It definitely keeps us going.
Yeah, even on Reddit as well.
Yeah, yeah. Regardless, positive, negative, starting conversations, whatever. As long as we're contributing to the community, we're happy. So, thanks, guys.
That's what we do, yeah. Like, when we put out this content, especially when we write articles and things, like, that's the one thing we want to do is when we generate conversation. And that's what we've had a few people approach me about wanting to write articles, and they said, what should I write about? And like, anything you think will generate some sort of discussion is what we want.
Anything worth talking about.
Yeah, exactly right. That's what we're all about here. We're not trying to be too self-serving or anything like that. And it's just really good to engage with the community, especially with people like, you know, Dave in the UK and some of his friends that engage with us on Twitter, and in particular Hollis and people like Ian from FFG who engage with us on Twitter.
Jaffa from FFG. And
yeah. It's all just really good. It's really good to be part of this giant online community, even though we're so remote.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all criminals, obviously, because that's what we're doing in Australia.
I'm Leela, yeah.
Yeah, and Shilzy is Leela, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool that a bunch of people have decided that they want to listen to us, and we hope that trend continues in the future, and hopefully grows.
Whenever my mother asks me how many people listen to your podcast, I say, more than I actually know that play Netrunner, so that makes it, as long as I can continue to say that, it's fine. Yeah.
It's pretty impressive, hey, like, even if, you know, we divide it through by the number of episodes, Netrunner, presuming everyone listens to it once, Netrunner has a big base. And everyone we see jacked in on the Reddit forums or on StimHack, that's only a small portion.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
right.
Only a small portion. And there are so many people just sitting and playing it like a board game, but, you know, listening to podcasts every day or not necessarily engaging with the online community because there are so many packs, there's so much content to absorb before you can really get into that and understand what people are really talking about. But, yeah, that doesn't stop people listening to a radio show.
Exactly right. Okay, guys, we're going to get back into it with the second half of Breaker Bay, focusing on the Corp cards. The first card is an HB agenda. It's Research Grant. It's a 3-for-1. When you score Research Grant, you may store another copy of Research Grant that is installed. So the idea is that if you score one, you've got another couple in play. You can score them out and chain them. Jesse, do you like this card?
I don't really. HB's got a decent agenda suite already. I'm not sure that this is really going to replace any of the commonly played agendas currently. I also don't really see how this fits into any particular strategy in a powerful way. I mean, if you're playing some sort of shell game, which seems to be the most efficient way that you can get multiple remotes happening, I'm not sure HB is particularly good at that in the first place, but then I'm not sure this is a particularly high percentage way of doing it. Like, playing out some naked 3-for-1s, hoping they don't steal them and hoping that you can steal them later doesn't seem great. So, yeah, I'm currently not seeing this working, but there may be some way in the future that it'll work. But, yeah, currently, I can't see it.
Jesse's absolutely right. There are so many good 4-for-2s. There are so many good 3-for-1s. Gillahan's Arcology and Kronos projects come to mind, but they also have Director Haas's Pet Project, which is far and away the, in my opinion, the best 3-1. So look, maybe there will be a deck in the Argus Security-esque style that does want to play more agendas than not. Maybe even playing Shipment from Miramorph, or who really knows. But I think this card will bridge some gaps in between the remote and fast advanced style of play, provided that NAPD contracts comes down in power.
Yeah, and one of the other things that's worth mentioning about this is how reliant it is on you drawing the other copies of it to be even able to do anything. And if you're playing cards in your deck that are exclusively or mainly for the purpose of installing these, it's reasonably hard to defend agendas in your centrals at the best of times, but trying to defend particular agendas is even harder.
Yeah, it definitely just goes back to the concept of synergy versus strategy, and you don't want to overload your synergy at the cost of your overall power. The next card we're talking about is an HB Ice. It's Turing. It's a Strength 2 Res 4 Code Gate. Turing has +3 strength while protecting a remote server. The runner cannot use AI programs to break subroutines on Turing. Its one subroutine reads, end the run unless the runner spends 3 clicks. Now, Will, for you are a Haas Bioroid, so what do you think of this card?
Yeah, so I'm a little wary about this card because it has a couple restrictions that I think are a bit worrying. The first is that it's only really efficient when it's on a remote server. If it's on a central server, you know, it only has one subroutine, 2 strength for 4 cost. That's really not what you want to pay. And even if it's on a remote, they can pay 3 clicks if they want to get through it. And of course, while that's a good trade for you, if you're trying to score an agenda through it, it's backbreaking. And I think that if this card is going to be good, it's going to be on the strength of the second ability. It kind of is a swordsman-esque way to protect both your centrals, but also your remotes, because it forces them to get a code gate breaker. So if they're relying on, say, Crypsis or to get into your remotes, or some sort of Eater silverware or something like that, then the fact that it needs an actual code gate breaker to get through on centrals efficiently is, I think, what is going to make it powerful if it is.
And just on that, even if they do click through the Turing, it's actually firing a subroutine, so they're not breaking it, not like Victor 2.0. And I think Victor 2.0 is probably, in my mind, the most comparable HB card, given that, at least when I play, I tend to put Victor 2.0 on my remote.
In terms of answering commonly played icebreakers, I think in terms of the meta where it's at the moment, Refractor is seeing quite a lot of play. And the thing that's really brought this card down in my eyes, I really liked it when I first saw it at Worlds in the draft packs. But now that Refractor is seeing so much play, being strength 5 code gate puts it in range of the single pump from Refractor, and only one subroutine means you're only taxing them one credit beyond that. So I think that's actually a really big downside as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a really bad format for 5 strength code gates at the moment, I think.
The next card we're talking about is Crick. It's a Jinteki Ice code gate. 3 strength, 1 to res. Crick has +3 strength while protecting archives. Its one subroutine reads, install a card from archives paying its install cost. Shieldsy, do you like this one?
Yeah, and on that note, it's a really good format for 6 strength code gates. And on archives, that's exactly what this is. I really like Crick. I think it has a particular niche, but I really look forward to employing that niche and playing a Crick as the single ice on archives in my RP control deck.
Yeah, also, this is absolutely phenomenal in industrial genomics. Putting this over archives means that if they do want to run and they can't break this, and they want just sort of in the early to mid game just to turn your face down cards face up in archives, they're going to risk triggering off your space camps and allowing you to install either an agenda or a trap into play, or a hostile asset like Ronin. So it can actually turn on a lot of your combos quite a lot earlier than you would be able to do so manually, which is a big upside.
The next card we're talking about is Recruiting Trip. It's a Jinteki operation. It costs X. Search R&D for up to X different size SOPs by title. Reveal them and add them to HQ. Shuffle R&D. So this is a SysOp tutor. Are any of the SysOps worth playing an extra card in order to get them is the question. Shieldsy?
Yeah, I think there's definitely space there. Like Akitara Watanabe, I think, is a really good one.
That has seen absolutely no play up until just this moment when everybody had to go and look at what the card does.
No, he's definitely
yeah,
decent.
Yeah, Akitara is definitely
he's vulnerable in centrals, and this fixes that.
The reason Akitara suffers so much is because you don't want to play too many of them because he's so narrow, but you want to play enough of them that when you build the right server for him, you can have access to it. And if that's, I don't know, if that's a cell portal server with a overscored brains trust and you only want one Akitara with a Nubby, Recruiting Trip's going to be good for that. And look, like,
but do you want to be playing this card if you've only got one SysOp in your deck? And if so, why wouldn't you just play more copies of him then? Because this is even more narrow than having him, so, right? Because you can't lock this in an agenda.
Absolutely.
Can we just figure out what the SysOps are before we go deep on this?
Well, I mean, the fact that we don't know what they are is like, well, Simone Diego, Benice Mai, Akatira Watanabe, Midori, I think that's it.
No.
Yeah. Well, like, there's a spread you can grab there of Akatara Watanabe, Midori and Benice Mai that will satisfy, it starts off a shell game. It starts off a tagging shell game and lets you potentially res the server at a cheaper cost.
That sounds so awful.
It does, absolutely.
The next card we're talking about is an NBN asset called Blacklist. It costs 0 to res, 3 to trash. It reads, cards cannot leave the runner's heap for any reason.
Any reason whatsoever.
I think that this card is 100% unplayable.
How do you think it works with Kronos Project, though? Do you think the cards can still leave the game? Oh, no, it's any reason, just for any reason. Sorry. Yeah.
The problem with these kind of cards is that if they're relevant, then the runner can just trash them, and if they're not relevant, they're literally blanks. It's not even they're barely relevant, they just don't do anything.
If my opponent concedes the game, is he allowed to shuffle his deck?
Yeah, they have to keep them in the game still.
The next card we're talking about is Gutenberg. It's an NBN Ice, 2 to res, 3 strength sentry, Tracer. Gutenberg has +3 strength while protecting R&D. Its one subroutine is Trace 7. If successful, give the runner one tag. Jesse, is this card good enough?
I think this card's really great. It's if you want an ice that's very likely to give the runner tags in the early game, this is it. It's going to do more work for you than Data Raven at actually landing those tags early. And in NBN, that's been one of the things.
Yeah, they can't just turn around and leave this.
Yeah, they can't just jack out. And the Trace is so powerful at Trace 7 that they're pretty much always going to take it. So, I mean, obviously with that sort of thing, you're relying on them running late in the turn, which they're not necessarily going to be doing. But it is definitely a significant tax. Every time they want to get into R&D, they're going to have to pretty much take a tag. So that's decent for 2 cost.
Yeah, I think that the main advantage to this card is that 7 is enough that can be played in strategies that aren't necessarily the core set making, like NBN identity, that you can try use this to tag them even if you don't have the 2 free recurring credits from the Make and Use identity.
The first Wayland card in this pack is sure to hit some of our listeners right where it hurts. It's called Student Loans. It's a 2 cost asset with a 3 trash cost. It reads, as an additional cost to play an event that there is a copy of in his or her heap, the runner must pay 2 credits.
Those strawberries look delicious. I wish I could afford strawberries like that. No.
He can't either. He's got student loans.
It's on his credit card. The card suffers from a lot of the problems that assets generally suffer from if you're just sort of jamming it into your deck as an additional effect, in that, as Wilfie said before, if it's relevant, they can just go and trash it most of the time. And obviously, if you're playing a strategy that's making your assets particularly hard to trash or trying to beef up your assets in some way, this could be part of that taxing strategy, things like hostile infrastructure, etc. Although it is 2 influence. At 1 influence, you could potentially see it being part of a strategy like that, but that might be a bit hard at 2. However, the effect, if you can make it stick, is reasonably powerful. A lot of events are going to be played as 3 ofs. A lot of the most powerful economy on the runner side is events. A lot of runners are still playing event-based economies, Andy and Kate particularly, which are both tier 1 runners. So this is going to hit them in a way, hit them where it hurts in terms of their economy and their economic development in the mid-game, potentially opening up some windows for you there. But yeah, the challenge is definitely going to be making it stick.
The next Wayland card is certainly going to shut Jesse up. It's a piece of ice. It's called Merumati. Res cost 2, strength 1, barrier. Merumati has +3 strength while protecting HQ. 1 subroutine is end the run. Wilfie, do you like it?
I feel a little discontent that they had this thing where they talked about famous people, and then 1, there are no women, and 2, they had to find some fictional person.
Oh, who was the fictional
Merumati.
One?
Merumati.
Merumati.
Oh, okay. So 3 of these people were normal, and then Merumati is just from their universe. Hmm. They couldn't find a female engineer anyway, or anyone that did anything interesting. That's a good, very good point, Wilfie, one worth raising.
Considering the game is about computer science, and as a person that studies mathematics and computer science, all of my heroes are women in computer science. It is a little bit disappointing.
Yes.
The card, I think, is quite good. At its worst, it's basically an ice wall, and if you can play it in addition to another ice of a different type on HQ, that it really, really makes siphoning hard from turn 2 or turn 3, basically. And that's one of the ways in which those cheap, low-strength barriers could falter in the late game was that, even if you have them on HQ, even if you've stacked multiple types such that they need to get multiple breakers before running, if they can get multiple siphons off, chaining siphons, then it didn't really matter that you had all different types and that you could stop them for the first couple turns. As soon as they could get in once, then they could just keep on siphoning. And this kind of alleviates this a little bit by being ice that when you put it on HQ, it's much harder to break than it costs more to break than it does to play, and I think that's really significant when it only costs one more than it's basically what it's competing against, which is Ice Wall.
The last card for Breaker Bay is a neutral corp card. It's a zero res upgrade region called Breaker Bay Grid. The res cost of cards in this server is lowered by 5, limit 1 region per server. Before everyone goes scrambling to grab their Sansans and dust them off, this is a region. You can't put it in the same server as a Sansan. Shieldsy, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's still got a lot of potential to see play, though. We can res Adonis campaigns and Eve campaigns with this bad boy.
Yeah, no, it seems sweet, though. Having neutral upgrades, there's only one other neutral upgrade, if I recall correctly, which is Will-O-The-Wisp. Upgrades are a very powerful card type. There aren't a lot of them in neutral. This is going to potentially enable some really significant use of remote servers in a way that we haven't seen before, utilizing, as you said, Shieldsy, things like Eve campaign, and bringing them back to being far more efficient than they were. So, yeah, it's definitely buffing the power of assets.
And on top of that, Jesse, you can put other upgrades in there as well, non-region upgrades. So if you do want to run a server with hostile infrastructure, Breaker Bay, Grid, and, I don't know,
an Ash,
and a Will-O-The-Wisp, and just keep them down, like, that's a thing you can do.
I honestly think it might be possible to build something with, like, the Root.
Yeah, that's true.
Is the Root a region?
No. It's an asset.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you can put it in a server and just use it slowly to build your board. I mean, I know it's a bit, you know, strange, but
I think it's good.
All right, so that was Breaker Bay. I think I speak for all of us when I say, despite the jokes we've made this particular episode, we're pretty excited for this cycle so far, and particularly this pack seems really good.
Breaker Bay and the Valley have been so big.
Yeah. Well, we've got a few minutes left. I wanted to discuss a concept that Wilfie and Shieldsy actually brought to my attention before. Like, as I've said a number of times in this podcast, I'm still sort of a student myself in the school of all these other fantastic Netrunner players that I surround myself with here, especially Wilfie in particular. So the concept of the Gauntlet, which is a sort of a playtesting strategy, I want to say. Wilfie, why don't you explain it?
Yeah, so the idea of creating a gauntlet is to try and optimize your playtesting process, which is something we've talked about before, but not for a while. So maybe I'll take a step back and say that playtesting is where you play games of Netrunner with a concerted idea of trying to get something out of it in terms of understanding, say, how your deck performs against other decks in the format that you're likely to play against it, say, your next game night or your next regionals or whatever. Like, it's widely applicable. And so the idea of creating a gauntlet is to, you know, make some decks that you can play with and against that hopefully form a representative sample of what you might come up against commonly at a tournament, so that when you play the tournament you're not confused by your opponent's strategy and you have some experience with playing against their type of, you know, their strategy, basically.
Yeah, in many ways, a gauntlet is an artificial metagame that we create with the attempt of replicating what we want to beat or what we expect we'll have to beat to win the event that we want to win. And when I say artificial, I mean that it's, well, not natural. In a lot of ways, most of the metagames that we'll come across will be quite natural, whether it's you and a few friends playing around the table on Friday night and you'll tailor your decks around each other, or maybe it's just a husband and wife, or maybe it's just, you know, you and your locals at the store. You know, there might be 15 of you or 16 of you, but, you know, Jesse Marshall rocks up every week with a Wayland deck, and Wolfie Horry rocks up every week with an IT department deck, and then, yeah, that's a metagame that appears naturally. The Gauntlet is artificial. What we do instead is we say, what decks do I think are good enough to make the top 8, and then can I beat them? What of those decks should I choose? And so you build this gauntlet of decks, you know, maybe 6 or 8 decks, depending on exactly how diverse the tier 1 archetypes or what you expect to be a tier 1 archetypes are across corps and runners, and then, yeah, you just test the absolute hell out of it.
Yeah, I think something that's really important to know is that you only have a limited amount of time, no matter how much time you have specifically, and so it's really important to limit the number of decks that you're playing with and against, so you can get a deeper understanding of how the matchup goes for each one. Like, it doesn't really make much sense to make 10 or 20 decks because, you know, you won't necessarily be able to play them or have people who will be able to play them at optimal capacity, just because at some point you just get to a cliff where someone just doesn't have any experience with an archetype, and also you're going to get less and less likely to see that archetype at a tournament. And so, you know, you really want to concentrate on, I think, maybe 2 to 4 major archetypes from each side. I think that's a good sort of baseline to go off, because, you know, in most formats, I'm trying not to be super contextualized here, like you can listen to this maybe a year in the future and get the same results, but hopefully no matter what the metagame, there are usually only going to be a couple of really, really good decks, and then some other decks which are strategically a bit different, and while those decks aren't going to be as strong, they're also important to play against. So, you know, decks which function in sort of completely different ways to the tier 1 decks, so you can't, because the whole point of testing is to sort of get a knowledge transfer, like, I know how to play against one deck, how can I use that to play against another deck which might be similar? And when two decks are too dissimilar, you know, usually you have to play against both of them to understand what things are going to be important in the matchup. Usually they're not going to overlap too much.
Yeah, I often read online, usually when people are complaining about what they believe to be an overpowered card or overpowered deck, is they say, oh, you know, my friend put that deck together and I tried, you know, 10 or 15 different decks against it and not one of them could beat it. And I think what you're saying there about the idea of the gauntlet and only having a few very powerful decks and then actually, you know, sort of spamming out those games so you get a deeper understanding of the archetype and how to actually beat them with one particular deck rather than just scrapping it when you don't win the first game and then starting again. I don't think that's the optimal way to play test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Lucas was saying in his presentation that we all saw online last week. Every faction, regardless of every deck, regardless of which faction it is and regardless of how well it's built, will have holes. They will have weaknesses, and
that's game design.
Yeah, it's really good game design, and so every deck will have pressure points that you can target to bring it down. And it's about finding the right deck for you that can target the pressure points that you want to target, as well as be familiar enough with you that you have enough experience with to pilot effectively. And this is again part to do with the size of your gauntlet. If your gauntlet is larger, I tend to want to play one deck against the field of 7. Whereas when the gauntlet is smaller, you just presuming that you have the same amount of time, regardless of how large your gauntlet is, you can be in the position to learn all of these decks in depth. Because that's a big thing, just like Wolfie was saying, when you move from one deck to another, there's always a gap in the quality of play that you can bring to the new deck, simply because you need to learn how to play the new deck, you need to learn where its pressure points are, you need to learn how you can play, make all those unique little plays that are bad elsewhere, but are really good here, or necessary even here, like when to ice up against a Gabriel Santiago for the threat of Sneak Door, or when to not leave your Jacksons unrezzed in case they have a bank job, or maybe in case they have a Hades shard. So I guess one other thing with the gauntlet is when you're testing decks to this kind of severity, one thing you get to do is decide whether that deck is in or out of the gauntlet. And it's a concept, I guess, has been called before a Wilson set, I believe.
Basically, it helps you eliminate a deck which could maybe not belong there if it's consistently losing.
Yeah, if a deck is consistently losing, regardless of who's piloting and regardless of how hard they're playing it, maybe it doesn't belong to be there. And if you can whittle that gauntlet down to a smaller size, it sounds like it's mostly a zoological kind of thing, but having an idea of which decks exist and how they stack up against each other in terms of their tiers is intrinsic to winning the top 8, because they're the decks you're going to see there. You're going to see those decks that are tier 1 or tier 1.5 with players prepared to pilot them perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. Especially I guess the kind of events. Like point is that you should basically come to similar conclusions to everyone else who's doing similar things to you, right? It's kind of a causal process. And so if you've decided that, you know, of course you can't work on every deck to the same extent, but if you've found that one deck that you thought was good just isn't winning at all, like it just loses no matter what it's playing against, and presumably other people have either worked on it and tuned it to a different form or given it up entirely. And so trying to work out when you should, you know, just scrap your efforts is another important part.
Excellent. And particularly leading up to regional season, I think it'd be a really good time, and I encourage everybody to try out the gauntlet way of testing. I know we'll certainly be doing it coming up to the regionals in Adelaide in about a month's time, and possibly even the regionals in Sydney. We might be up there as well. Please get in contact with us, guys, and let us know what you think, especially about the gauntlet testing. You can do so via our email, thewinningagenda@gmail.com. You can hit us up on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. Or you can find us on Twitter at Winning Agenda. Additionally, if you guys would like to support us a little bit, you can jump onto Inked Playmats, search The Winning Agenda, and hook up some sweet, sweet Winning Agenda playmat swag for your next big tournament. Till next week, guys. We'll look forward to hearing from you. See
ya. Thanks,
guys. Take it easy.
Thanks for listening.
The next card is Recruiting Trip. It's a Jinteki operation. It costs X credits. Search R&D for up to six... six specifically. That's the exact number.
You have to play six. Yeah.
I thought you had to find 10.
Yeah.